And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Ellen Fisher. Today I'll be reading from the book On Seashore Far, A Green Oak Tower. The Blind Horse by Konstantin Ussinsky. A long time ago, a very long time ago, before not only we, but also our grandfathers and great-grandfathers were born, the rich, large trading town of Vinyetska stood on the seashore, and in this town lived a rich merchant by the name of Icon, whose ships laden with precious wares plied the seas far and wide. Icon was very rich and lived in luxury. Perhaps his very name, Alton, or All at Home, came from the fact that his home contained everything good and precious that could be found at that time. And the master himself, his wife, and children ate only from gold and silver and dressed only in sable and brocade. In Alton's stables were many fine horses, but there was none in these stables or in the whole of Vinyetka more fleet of foot or more handsome than Chase the Wind, as Alton called his favorite saddle horse, because of its fleetness of foot. No one dared mount Chase the Wind but the owner himself, and he never rode another steed. On one of his travels to see to his affairs, the merchant was returning to Vinyetka, and he happened to be riding through a large, dark forest on his beloved horse. Evening was approaching, and the forest was very dark and dense. The wind rocked the tops of the sullen firs. The merchant was traveling alone, trotting slowly to spare his beloved horse, who was tired from the long journey. Suddenly, out of the bushes, as if from nowhere, sprang six robust men with brutal faces, in ragged caps, with bare spears, axes, knives in their hands. Three were mounted and three on foot, and two of the robbers were about to catch the horse by the bridle. Had he been riding another horse instead of Chase the Wind, the rich Alton would never have seen his native Vinyetka again. Feeling a strange hand on the bridle, the horse shot ahead, its broad, powerful chest knocking to the ground the two bold villains who held it by the bridle. Trampled a third, who had run forward to bar its way, waving his bear spear, and sped off like the wind. The mounted robbers set off in pursuit. Their horses were good, too, but how could they catch up Alton's speed? In spite of its tiredness, Chase the Wind sensed the pursuit and raced like an arrow from a tightly drawn bow, leaving the furious scoundrel far behind. Half an hour later, Alton was riding into his native Vinyetka on his good horse, in which the lather was streaming down. Dismounting from the horse, whose flanks had risen high with exhaustion, the merchant stroked Chase the Wind's sweating neck and solemnly vowed that whatever happened, he would never sell or give away his loyal horse, never drive it away however old it was, and feed it three measures of the best oats each day until it died. But Alton was in a hurry to greet his wife and children and did not see to the horse himself, and the lazy groom did not look after the exhausted horse, did not let it cool down, and gave it water too soon. From that day, Chase the Wind grew ill and sickly, its legs became weak, and finally it went blind. The merchant grieved bitterly, and for 6 months kept his promise. The blind horse remained in the stable, and each day it was fed 3 measures of oats. Then Alton bought himself another saddle horse, and 6 months later he decided it was wasteful to give a blind, good-for-nothing horse 3 measures of oats, and ordered that it be given 2. Another 6 months passed. The blind horse was still young and would have to be fed for a long time, so they began to give it 1 measure a day. Finally, the merchant decided that this was also too much, and ordered Chase the Wind to be unbridled and driven out of the gates. so that it did not take up room in the stable. The grooms drove the blind horse out with a stick because it dug in its heels and would not budge. Poor blind Tristan did not understand what was happening, and not knowing or seeing where to go, stayed by the gate, head hanging and ears moving sadly. Night came and began to snow. Sleeping on the cobbles was hard and cold for the poor blind horse. It stood on the same spot for several hours, but finally hunger drove it in search of food. Lifting its head and sniffing at least for a bunch of straw from the old sagging roof, the blind horse wandered at random, bumping into the corners of houses and fences. I should explain that in the Yurtup, as in all old Slav towns, there was no prince, and the town dwellers ruled themselves, gathering on the square when it was necessary to decide matters of importance. This assembly of the people to decide its own affairs, administer justice, and mete out punishment was called a dyepsia. In the middle of the Yurta, in the square where the dyepsia used to meet, from four posts hung the large dyepsia bell, which summoned the people together and could be rung by anyone who felt that he had been wronged and wanted judgment and protection from the people. Of course, no one would dare to ring the dyepsia bell for a trifle because they knew the people would punish them for it. Wandering over the square, the blind, deaf, and hungry horse happened to bump into the post on which the bell hung, and hoping perhaps to find a bunch of straw from the eaves, caught hold of the rope tied to the bell's tongue and its teeth and began to pull. The bell clanged so loudly that although it was still very early, the people came running to the square, curious to know who was demanding their judging and protection so loudly. Everyone in Nyesha knew Chase the Wind, knew that he had saved his master's life, and knew about his master's promise. So they were surprised to see the poor horse, blind, hungry, shivering with the cold and covered with snow in the middle of the square. It soon transpired what was the matter, and when the people learned that the rich Alton had driven away the horse who had saved his life, they decided unanimously that Chase the Wind was quite right to ring the dyepsia bell. They summoned the ungrateful merchant to the square, and in spite of his attempts to justify himself, ordered him to keep the horse as before and feed it until the day it died. A special person was appointed to see that the sentence was carried out, and the sentence itself was carved on the stone set up to commemorate this event in the dyepsia The Righteous Judge by Lev Tolstoy. An Algerian ruler by the name of Bavaka wanted to find out for himself whether it was true, as he had been told, that in one of his towns there lived a righteous judge who could immediately recognize the truth and no rogue could deceive him. Bavaka dressed up as a merchant and set off on horseback for the town where the judge lived. By the gateway into the town, a cripple came up to Bavaka and began to beg alms. Bavaka gave him some money and was about to ride on when the cripple caught hold of his cloak. "What do you want?" asked Bavaka. "Haven't I given you alms?" "Oh, yes, you have," said the cripple, "but do me another favor. Carry me on your horse to the square, or I'll be crushed by the horses and camels." Bavaka set the cripple behind him and carried him to the square. And in the square, Bavaka stopped the horse. But the cripple did not get off. Bavaka said, "Oh, why are you sitting here? Get down, we have arrived." But the beggar said, "Why should I get down? It's my horse. And if you won't give up the horse of your own free will, let's go to the judge." People had gathered round it and were listening to their argument, and they all shouted, "Go to the judge, we'll settle the dispute." The rockets and the cripple went to the judge. There were other people there too, and the judge called them by turn to settle their dispute. Before it was the rockets' turn, the judge called a scholar and a peasant. They were quarreling over a wife. The peasant said it was his wife, and the scholar said it was hers. The judge heard them out, paused for a moment and said, leave the wife with me and come back tomorrow. When they had left, a butcher and an oil seller came in. The butcher was covered with blood and the oil seller with oil. The butcher was holding money in his hand and the oil seller the butcher's arm. And the butcher said, I bought some oil from this man and drew out my purse to pay, but he grabbed my arm and tried to take the money. And that's how we've come to you, I holding a purse in my hand and he holding my arm. But the money is mine and he is a thief. But the oil seller said, that's not true. The butcher came to me to buy oil. After I had poured him a full jug, he asked me to change a gold piece. I got the money and put it on the counter. Then he took it and tried to run off. I caught him by the arm and brought him here. The judge paused for a moment and said, leave the money here and come back tomorrow. When it was the turn of Barakas and the cripple, Barakas recounted what had happened. The judge heard him out and then asked the cripple. The beggar said, that's not true. I was riding on my horse through the town, and he was sitting on the ground and asked me to give him a ride. I put him on my horse and took him where he wanted to go, but he wouldn't get off and said it was his horse. That's not true. The judge sat for a moment and said, leave the horse with me and come back tomorrow. The next day, many people gathered to hear the judge's verdict. The first to come up were the scholar and the peasant. Take your wife, the judge said to the scholar, and give the peasant 50 strokes. The scholar took his wife, and the peasant was punished forthwith. Next, the judge called the butcher. The money is yours, he said to the butcher. Then he pointed to the oil seller and said, he's to be given 50 strokes. Then the Barakas and the cripple were summoned. Would you know your horse from 20 others? The judge asked the Barakas. I would. And you? Oh, I would too, said the cripple. Come with me, the judge said to the Barakas. They went into the stable. The Barakas immediately pointed to his horse among the other 20. Then the judge called the cripple into the stable and ordered him to point to the horse. The cripple recognized the horse and pointed to it. Then the judge sat down on his seat and said to the Barakas, the horse is yours. Take it. And the cripple is to be given 50 strokes. After the trial, the judge went off home and the Barakas followed him. What's the matter? Are you not happy with my decision? Asked the judge. I'm happy with it, said the Barakas, but I should like to know how you find out that the wife belonged to the scholar and not to the peasant, that the money belonged to the butcher and not the oil seller, and that the horse was mine and not the cripple. I found out about the wife like this. In the morning, I summoned her to me and asked her to fill my inkwell with ink. She picked up the inkwell, washed it quickly, and deftly poured in the ink. Though she was obviously used to doing this, had she been the peasant's wife, she would not have been able to do it. So the scholar was right. I found out about the money like this. I put the money in a cup of water and looked at it this morning to see whether there was any oil on the surface. If the money had been the oil seller's, it would have had oil on it from his hand. There was no oil in the water. So obviously, the butcher was telling the truth. It's harder to find out about the horse. Both the cripple and you immediately pointed it out from the other 20 horses. But I did not take you both into the stable to see whether you knew the horse, but to see which of you the horse knew. When you walked up to it, it turned its head and moved towards you. But when the cripple touched it, it flattened its ears and raised its legs, so I knew that you were the true owner of the horse. Then the Barakas said, I am no merchant, but the ruler, the Barakas. I came here to see whether it was true what is said about you. I see now that you are a wise judge. Ask me for anything you like, and I will reward you. I need no reward, said the judge. You've been listening to stories from on Seashore Fire, a Green Oak Tower, a book of tales published by Rodega Publishers in Moscow. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilson. The executive producer is Paula Tamara. And I'm Ellen Spitzer. And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Marcia Turner, and I'm Vicki Andrews, and today we'll be reading a story, The Southpaw by Judith York, and Ladies First by Sal Silverstein from the book Free to Be You and Me, and we'll be also reading the story Penny Look by Harvey Zeno. The Southpaw. Dear Richard, don't invite me to your birthday party because I'm not coming. And give back the Disneyland sweatshirt I said you could wear. If I'm not good enough to play on your team, I'm not good enough to be friends with. Your former friend, Janet. P.S. I hope when you go to the dentist, you find 20 cavities. Dear Janet, here's your stupid Disneyland sweatshirt if that's how you're gonna be. And I want my comic books back now, finished or not. No girl has ever played on the Mate Street baseball team, and as long as I'm captain, no girl ever will. Your former friend, Richard. P.S. I hope when you go for your checkup, you need your tetanus shot. Dear Richard, I'm changing my goldfish's name from Richard to Stanley. Don't count on my vote for class president next year. Just because I'm a member of the ballet club doesn't mean I'm not a terrific ball player. Your former friend, Janet. P.S. I see you lost your first game, 28-0. Dear Janet, I'm not saving any more sushi on the bus. Sorry, I care you can stand the whole way to school. Just forget about baseball and learn something nice like knitting. Your former friend, Richard. P.S. Wait till Wednesday. Dear Richard, my father said I could call someone to go with us for a ride in Hot Fudge Sundays. In case you didn't notice, I didn't call you. Your former friend, Janet. P.S. I see you lost the second game, 34-0. Dear Janet, remember when I took the laces out of my blue and white sneakers and gave them to you? I want them back. Your former friend, Richard. P.S. Wait till Friday. Dear Richard, congratulations on your unbroken record. 8 straight losses. Wow. I understand you're the laughingstock of New Jersey. Your former friend, Janet. P.S. Why don't you and your team forget about baseball and learn something nice, like knitting, maybe? Dear Janet, here's a silver horseback riding trophy that you gave me. I don't think I want it anymore. Your former friend, Richard. P.S. I didn't think you'd be the kind of kick a man when he's down. Dear Richard, I wasn't kicking exactly. I was kicking back. Your former friend, Janet. P.S. In case you were wondering, my batting average is .345. Dear Janet, Alfie is having his concert out tomorrow, and we might be able to let the catch next week. Richard, dear Richard, I pitch. Janet. Dear Janet, Joel is moving to Kansas, and Danny sprained his wrist. How about a permanent place in the outfield? Richard. Dear Richard, I pitch. Janet. Dear Janet, Ronnie caught the chicken pox, and Leo broke his toe, and Elwood has these stupid violin lessons. I'll give you first base, and that's my final offer. Richard. Dear Richard, Susan Riley played first base. Marilyn Jackson catches. Ezra Khan plays center field. I pitch. It's a package deal. Janet. P.S. Sorry about the 12-game losing streak. Dear Janet, please, not Marilyn Jackson. Richard. Dear Richard, nobody ever said that I was unreasonable. How about Lizzie Martindale instead? Janet. Dear Janet, at least, could you call your goldfish Richard again? Your friend, Richard. Ladies first. Did you hear the one about the little girl who was a tender sweet young thing? Well, that's the way she thought of herself. And this tender sweet young thing spent a great deal of time just looking in the mirror saying, I'm a real little lady. Anybody could tell that. I wear lovely starched cotton dresses with matching ribbons in my lovely curly locks. I wear clean white socks and shiny black cotton leather shoes, and I always put just the dab of perfume behind each ear. When she was at the end of the lunch line at school, all she had to say was, ladies first, ladies first. And she'd get right up to the front of the line. Well, her life went on like that for quite a while, and she wound up having a pretty good time, you know, admiring herself in mirrors, always getting to be first in line and stuff like that. And then one day, she went exploring with a whole group of other people through the wilds of a deep and beastly jungle. She went along through the tangled trails and prickly vines. She would say things like, I have got to be careful of my lovely dress and my nice white socks and my shiny, shiny shoes and my curly, curly locks. So, would somebody please clear the way for me?
And they did.
Or sometimes she'd say, well, do you mean that I have enough mangoes to go around and I'll have to share my mango because I was the last one across that icky river full of crocodiles and snakes. No matter how last I am, it's still ladies first. Ladies first. So hand over a whole mango, please.
And they did.
Well, then guess what happened? Out of nowhere, the exploring party was seized, grabbed by a bunch of hungry tigers, and these tigers tied all the people up and dragged them back to their tiger lair, where they sniffed around, trying to decide what would make the best food.
Hey, how about this one? Nah, too bony. How about this one? Got a lot of meat on it. Meaty, but muscly. Oh, for heaven's sake, don't take all night. Never saw a pack such a pack of pickled ears. How about this one? Looks tender. Smells nice. I've never seen anything quite like it before. I wonder what it is.
I am a tender, sweet young thing. I'm also a little lady. You should know that by my lovely clothes and by my lovely smell. And if it's all the same to you, Tiger, sweetie, I wish you'd stop looking at me and untie me this instant. My dress is getting mucked.
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, we're all just trying to decide who to untie first.
Ladies first! Ladies first! And so she was.
And mighty tasty, too.
A penny a look. Once, there were two brothers. Everybody called the older one a red-headed rascal. No doubt about it, people said. He's got what it takes.
Someday, he'll be rich.
The other brother was different. People called him a lazy good-for-nothing. Because he hated to work. Don't pay any attention to that one, they said. He'll never amount to much. He'll never get anywhere.
she's a lazy good for nothing.
So the red-headed rascal had lots of ideas, and one day he said to his brother,
"Hey, look, I just found a map that shows the way to a place where some one-eyed people live. Now all you gotta do is go there and capture a one-eyed man, bring him back home, put him in a cage in the marketplace, and charge a penny a look. I will make millions."
"Is that so?"
said the lazy good for nothing.
"I got an idea. Why don't you go capture a one-eyed man, bring him back home, and when you have him in the cage, then maybe I'll have to collect the pain."
"Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. You have to come with me," said the red-headed rascal. He thought he might need a little help to capture one-eyed man. "Just keep me company on the trip, of course." And the lazy good-for-nothing didn't want to, but the red-headed rascal finally persuaded him to go along as a favor for a brother.
They left the very next morning. They took with them only the map and a rope for tying up the one-eyed man when they captured him.
They had to go a long way.
Now they had to drive 500 miles in an automobile.
And now they were driving, the lazy good-for-nothing said,
"By the way, what are you going to give him to eat?"
"Who?"
"The one-eyed man, when we have him back home in the cage."
"Oh, him. Don't worry, stop and come. No, you won't let him starve. I've got it all figured out." Then they had to wade across the stream, and while they were waiting, the lazy good for nothing said,
"By the way, is he gonna have to stay in that cage then all the time?"
"Who?"
"The one-eyed man. Is he gonna have to stay in that cage all the time?"
"Oh, him. Of course he is. You don't think we'd give him a chance to climb the trucks after going through all this trouble to catch him, do you? Now stop worrying and leave everything to me."
Then they had to climb over some fences,
and while they were climbing, the lazy good for nothing said,
"By the way, he's not going to like it very much, is he?"
"Who?"
"The one-eyed man. He's not going to like it very much with all those people staring at him all the time,
is he?" "Oh, him. That's all right. Like it or not, he won't be able to do anything about it. So no need to worry."
Then they had to fly over the desert in the balloon.
And while they were flying, the lazy good for nothing said,
"You know, I just can't help thinking that maybe it's not right."
"What?"
"Maybe it's not right to do this to a poor, helpless, one-eyed man."
"Don't be silly. Forget about him. Think of all the pain."
Finally, they arrived.
"Hey, this is the police. Now, come on, that's the first one we find."
Well, they searched and searched, but all they could see was a great big pile of rocks. Suddenly, from behind that pile of rocks, there appeared
a one-eyed man.
The brothers ran to catch him. But just then, a second one-eyed man appeared.
Then a whole bunch of one-eyed men came rushing up.
They caught the red-headed rascal and the lazy good for nothing and carried them to their town. They put that red-headed rascal in a cage in the middle of the marketplace and charged everybody a penny a look to see a two-eyed man with red hair.
They didn't pay much attention to the lazy good for nothing because they could see he would never amount to much.
They knew he'd never get anywhere, so they let him collect the pennies.
He didn't mind.
You've been listening to the stories The Southpaw by Judith Fiore and Lady First by Sarah Silverstein, adapted by Mary Rogers, from the book Free to Be, You and Me, published by McGraw-Hill, and A Penny a Look by Harv Zeno, published by Farrar, Strauss, Jewell. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Joe Sherrin. The executive producer is Carla Canella, and I'm Vicki Andrews,
and I'm Martha Kramer.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm Anne Vickers. Today I'll be reading through the story called The Seven Dishes by Alfred Smedberg. The Seven Dishes. If you had ever seen Ole Nicholson standing by his bundle of firewood in the forest, scratching his fiery, bristly head, you would probably have laughed until he ached. Ole Nicholson looked so different from other boys. He had hair as brown as a juniper bush burnt by the sun, a nose like a potato, and feet like two fat mushrooms. It wouldn't have been so bad if he had simply been ugly, but he was also so lazy he could scarcely bother to stand up again if he fell down, and so foolish he could not tell a squirrel from a crow. As he ambled about the forest with his mouth hanging open and his arms hanging down, he might have been taken for a monkey instead of a boy. He was so ugly and so foolish that even the magpies laughed. Just now, she said, he was standing in the forest near his bundle of firewood scratching his head. A seven-year-old child could easily have skipped for that little bunch of twigs, but Ole, who was 13 years old and strong as a bear, had spent the last hour wondering if he could lift it on his back. He was standing, fidgeting and sucking, when he saw a viper lying on the ground nearby. The viper was sharply and intently eyeing something small not far away. Ole looked more closely and saw a little frog hopping in stealth toward the viper's open mouth. If Ole had not been so foolish, he would have realized that the snake, with its keen eyes, attacked the spell of the frog so that it could hop straight forward right into the viper's mouth. "Oh, well," said Ole, astonished and wide-eyed. But he was too lazy to pick up his stick and kill the viper. Meantime, the frog hopped closer and closer to the viper's poisonous tongue. Finally, stupid as he was, Ole realized that the frog was terrified. He was trembling all over, and now again, it squeaked faintly. Ole opened his silly eyes wider and stepped near. "Look, young, you small, short, fat thing. Don't be so silly. Why don't you run away? Can't you see that the long black man wants to catch you?" It's the longest speech Ole had ever made in all his life, and it was so hard for him to make that he took off his cap and walked across the sky. But the frog kept hopping slowly near until finally it was just one hop away from the snake. The snake never moved its eyes from the frog. Then Ole lost his temper and picked up a stick and said, "You stupid little wretch, did I have to help you?" And with that, he poked the frog with a stick and knocked it aside into the grass where the snake could not see it. At once the frog jumped up onto Ole's bundle of firewood, and it sat watching him with beautiful, expressive eyes as if looking to thank him. "I have got to lift you too," Ole said crossly. "Don't you think the firewood is heavy enough already?" But the frog just sat there on the wood, gazing at Ole. Its look was so bright, gentle, and friendly that Ole was almost spellbound. Lazy and foolish, he stood there without even a sense to see the frog away. Meanwhile, the snake had wriggled off into the grass. Suddenly, the frog laughed, a laugh of clear silver. It jumped down from the firewood, and at that moment became a beautiful fairy girl with rosy cheeks, sky blue eyes, and curly gold hair. Ole was so astonished that Ole could say, "Oh!" Thank you, my friend, for saving my life, the fairy said in a voice as strong as a note from the heart. Oh, said Ollie again. You probably don't realize what you've done for me, said the fairy. I'm not a frog, as you see. I am queen of the fairies. I took the palace you gave your day in a small brook that flowed through the meadow. Oh, said Ollie, staring at the beautiful little elf. You may be wondering, the fairy went on, how I was a frog just a moment ago, so I will tell you straight away. Yesterday around noon, I committed a great sin. I laughed at a little frog that was hopping towards a big snake that cut its mouth open. I did not realize that the snake had climbed the frog so it couldn't escape, and I laughed at it for not sending away. That was wicked of me, and so I was punished. I was turned into a frog myself for 24 hours. There was just 10 minutes left when a viper appeared and climbed me too, put me under a spell. If he had not been there to save me, I would have been swallowed up and dead. Now did you realize what a fine deed you have done? Oh, ho, said Ollie, staring harder than ever. And now I want to reward you for your goodness, the fairy went on. I will give you 7 wishes, and whatever you wish for will be granted. And don't wish foolishly, or you will regret it later. Goodbye. And the witch, the fairy, floated away through the air towards the path that led to the brook. Oh, ho, ho, said Ollie, rubbing his elbow. That was fun. But now, what shall I wish for? Oh, yes, I know. It is the firewood with one hand by itself and tie me on its back. It raced through the forest and sent sticks and twigs, moss and pebbles flying through the air. Oh, he was terrified and had to dig his hands into the branches to hold on. The firewood went like the wind, flying wildly between hillocks and groves. It scalloped over stones and tree stumps. Oh, he was tossed and kicked. Hither and thither, he lost his cap and his wooden shoes, his face was whipped by bushes and branches, and he himself was bellowing like a cow. In a few minutes, the firewood reached the small cross where Ollie lived. It tore through the gate and into the yard. At the threshold, it stopped so abruptly that Ollie fell headlong through the door and bumped his head so hard it gave him the size of a lump. Oh my, said Ollie, getting to his knees. His mother, who believed the pig had slipped into the trough, came rushing from the kitchen with her broom. Ollie could say nothing but, oh my, and for he was so shaken that he quite forgot about the frog and the snake. The woman got so sorry for him that she gave him a bag of almond candy. And whenever Ollie got hold of something good to eat, he could never stop it enough. So now he sat down on a step and gobbled up all the candy in a wink. Yum, he said, licking his lips. I wish I had a pail full of this candy and could eat as much as I wanted. In a moment, a whole pail full of candy was dumped in his lap. Oh, my, Ollie exclaimed delightedly and began to grab fistfuls of almond candy from the pail. He ate so much and so quickly it would have made his biggest lesson. He stared and chewed and swallowed and then ate some more. He hunched over the pail until in 15 minutes it was empty and Ollie was as fat and round as a sausage. In a little while, Ollie was lying on the bed, wriggling like an ocean, with his hands on his stomach and yelling louder than a pig stuck in a fence. His mother sent for the doctor, who advised a full bottle of stomach bitters. In an hour, Ollie had been so sick that he was as empty as a hunting dog. When he felt well enough to explain what had happened, the wise doctor gave him a sound thrashing with a hazel stick. A week later, Ollie's mother sent him out to lead their little carrot patch. Reluctantly, Ollie went out to do the job, but being lazy, before he began, he lay down beside the carrot to rest for a while. And it just happened that there was also an enormous cherry tree in the garden, full of the biggest and reddest cherries, that could grew so high up that he could not reach them without climbing the tree. And the responsible boy would have found a ladder to lean against the tree, and that there could be right among the juicy cherries. But Ollie was both too silly and too lazy to think of that. So he lay under the tree and got angry with the crows and magpies that flew among the branches and picked one cherry after another. Oh, said Ollie, looking at the clip. Very strong, sitting up there at the top of the tree. And just as if a strong wind had lifted him from the ground, in a moment he was flying up into the tree. And there he hung on the topmost branches. Ollie shouted in delight and began kicking and eating. Now, if only he had not been too lazy to close the gate when he entered the garden, everything would have turned out all right. But with the gate open, the pig wandered in and began splashing its back against the cherry tree. You can imagine what happened there. The tree swayed back and forth with Ollie at the top like a magpie in a big twig in a storm. At last he lost hold and fell down head over heels. Twigs and branches broke as he went, and Ollie somersaulted wildly onto the back of the pig. It's hard to say which of these two cried loudest, Ollie or the pig. Certainly the pig never again broke such its back against the cherry tree with a boy in the branches, and for a week Ollie went around with cuts on his hands and red splashes on his cheeks and a swollen nose. You might suppose Ollie would never make a silly wish again, but like other stupid boys, he didn't remember any of his troubles after they stopped hating. But it was not more than a few weeks before Ollie had another adventure. On that day, he set out walking to the village. He seldom bothered to walk so far, and when he did, he dragged his feet all the way. He watched the bicycle pedaling by on the road. Oh, said Ollie, I wish I could sit on a bicycle like that and ride all over the countryside. He was astride the bicycle and pressing wildly forward. Where the bicycle had come from and how Ollie got on his feet, he did not know, but he sat there now pedaling and speeding along for all his worth. Ollie had never ridden a bicycle before and began to shout and yell at the top of his lungs. Now, was the bicycle better be heard? So it raced along, frightening those cows and people. If only the bicycle had kept to the road, things might have been easier. But the mischievous machine and Twitterbell racing over the countryside, this was all they had risked, and so it seldom rode on smooth ground. Ollie tried to stop pedaling, but quite impossible. Whether he liked it or not, he pedaled and bumped and jumped along across hills and tufty meadows, through cornfields and potato fields, over fences, ditches, and stone walls. Everywhere people ran from their homes to look at the madly careening cyclist. Ollie shouted and thumped and thumped and shouted, catch me, stop me. The villagers watched angrily as Ollie spoiled their crops and ran over their livestock. He rode pell-mell uncontrollably across corn fields and over flower beds, pushed the piglets aside and scared horses till they bolted. Sheep jumped, fences and hens flew tossing onto the rooster's vines. By now, the villagers had come out in force with sticks and poles to thump Ollie. With the town elders in the lead, farmers and farmhands marched towards Ollie in a body. Ollie's bicycle lunged towards him like a furious bull, knocked off the sexton's hat, pinned the parish clerk's legs, and gave the wicked farmer and the tiny such a solid poke in the stomach that he tumbled over with his heels in the air. Ollie was so frightened and nearly fainted. He could not understand the kind of monster he was riding. I wish the wretched thing would break into 100 pieces, he said. Immediately the bicycle rolled into the stone wall and was smashed to smithereens. Ollie himself somersaulted over the wall and landed in a clump of nettles. Immediately the villagers rushed forward to beat Ollie for the damage he had done. Not only the fields and gardens lavished, but he had run over and killed 3 pigs and 4 hens. The hen farmer saw him looking so frightened and exhausted, the villager stepped and left him in peace. Poor lad, they said, it's a pity. It's just stupid, he doesn't know what he's doing. And small wonder, he never even learned how to read. Ollie limped home, opening it over. He began to think about what the villagers had said. He did not learn how to read wonderfully well all at once.
and he did this with the moon and the fire spirit that he studied both day and night. Eventually, over to the new book he laid his hands on. And the more he read, the better he understood how foolish he had been and how lazy Ivan lay half his life. Now he helped his mother with all kinds of chores and began to be more diligent and industrious. One day, as he was working at the house, he saw the little boy coming again. He recognized her immediately and suddenly remembered his adventure with the frog and the snake. So since he had learned to read and write, his memory had improved. Oh, good day, dear Ollie, said the fairy in a mild voice. You wished foolishly 5 times. But your 6th wish was a wise one. Now you may have 1 more wish, but think carefully. This is the very last one, and after that I am not able to help you again. Ollie pondered a very long time. Reading and working so much, he had become quite comfortable, and that was the reason he was afraid to wish for something silly. Said at last, I wish to be a big, useless person. Couldn't make a better wish, said the fairy happily, and therefore I shall grant the wish that it will come of your own efforts, for what comes other ways isn't worth much. Goodbye. So the fairy took the word. Through study and hard work, Ollie became sensible, useful, and good, and everyone liked him. And as he became good, he also seemed more handsome, for only the lazy and wicked appear ugly. You've been listening to The 7 Wishes, a story from the book Great Swedish Fairy Tales, published by Jellicoe Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tamara. And I'm Ellen Pitcher.